of a ring-giver, now that the hand that bestowed so richly has been stilled in death. I have heard it said by my people in Hall, counselors who live in the upland country, that they have seen two such creatures prowling the moors, huge marauders from some other world. One of these things, as far as anyone ever can discern, looks like a woman. The other, warped in the shape of a man, moves beyond the pale, bigger than any man, an unnatural birth called Grendel by country people in former days. They are fatherless creatures, and their whole ancestry is hidden in a past of demons and ghosts. They dwell apart among wolves on the hills, on wind-swept crags and treacherous caches, where cold streams pour down the mountain and disappear under mist and moorland. A few miles from here, a frost-stiffened wood waits and keeps watch above a mere. The overhanging bank is a maze of tree roots mirrored in its surface. At night there, something uncanny happens. The water burns. And the mere bottom has never been sounded by the sons of men. On its bank, the heather stepper halts. The hart, in flight from pursuing hounds, will turn to face them with firm-set horns and die in the wood rather than dive beneath its surface. That is no good place. When wind blows up and stormy weather makes clouds scud and the skies weep, out of its depths a dirty surge is pitched towards the heavens. Now, help depends again on you, and on you alone. The gap of danger where the demon waits is still unknown to you. Seek it if you dare. I will compensate you for settling the feud as I did the last time, with lavish wealth, coffers of coiled gold, if you come back. Beowulf, son of Edgetheow, spoke. Why, sir, do not grieve. It is always better to avenge dear ones than to indulge in mourning. For every one of us, living in this world means waiting for our end. Let whoever can win glory before death. When a warrior is gone, that will be his best and only bulwark. So arise, my lord, and let us immediately set forth on the trail of this troll dam. I guarantee you she will not get away, not to dens underground, nor upland groves, nor the ocean floor. She'll have nowhere to flee to. Endure your troubles today, bear up, and be the man I expect you to be. With that, the old lord sprang to his feet and praised God for Beowulf's pledge. Then a bit and halter were brought for his horse with the plaited mane. The wise king mounted the royal saddle and rode out in style with a force of shield-bearers. The forest paths were marked all over with the monster's tracks. Her trail on the ground wherever she had gone across the dark moors, dragging away the body of that thane, Hrothgar's best counselor and overseer of the country. So the noble prince proceeded, undismayed, up fells and screes, along narrow footpaths and ways where they were forced into single file, ledges on cliffs above lairs of water monsters. He went in front with a few men, good judges of the lie of the land, and suddenly discovered the dismal wood, mountain trees growing out at an angle above gray stones. The bloodshot water surged underneath. It was a sore blow to all of the Danes, friends of the Shieldings, a hurt to each and every one of that noble company, when they came upon Asherah's head at the foot of the cliff. Everybody gazed as the hot gore kept wallowing up, and an urgent war horn repeated its notes. The whole party sat down to watch. The water was infested with all kinds of reptiles. There were writhing sea dragons and monsters slouching on slopes by the cliff, serpents and wild things such as those that often surface at dawn to roam the sail road and doom the voyage. Down they plunged, lashing in anger at the loud call of the battle bugle. An arrow from the bow of the Geat chief got one of them as he surged to the surface. The seasoned shaft stuck deep in his flank, and his freedom in the water got less and less. It was his last swim. He was swiftly overwhelmed in the shallows, prodded by barbed boar spears, cornered, beaten, pulled up on the bank, a strange lake berth, a loathsome catch, men gazed at in awe. Beowulf got ready, donned his war gear, indifferent to death. His mighty, hand-forged, fine-webbed mail would soon meet with the menace underwater. It would keep the bone cage of his body safe. No enemy's clasp could crush him in it. No vicious armlock choke his life out. To guard his head, he had a glittering helmet that was due to be muddied on the mere bottom and blurred in the upswirl. It was of beaten gold, princely headgear, hooped and hasped by a weaponsmith who had worked wonders in days gone by and adorned it with boar shapes. Since then, it had resisted every sword. And another item lent by Unverth at that moment of need was of no small importance. The Brehon handed him a hilted weapon, a rare and ancient sword named Hrunting. The iron blade, with its ill-boding patterns, had been tempered in blood. It had never failed the hand of anyone who hefted it in battle, anyone who had fought and faced the worst in the gap of danger. This was not the first time it had been called to perform heroic feats. When he lent that blade to the better swordsman, Unverth, the strong-built son of Edgelaf, could hardly have remembered the ranting speech he had made in his cups. He was not man enough to face the turmoil of a fight underwater and the risk to his life. So there he lost fame and repute. It was different for the other, rigged out in his gear, ready to do battle. Beowulf, son of Edgtheow, spoke. "Wisest of kings, now that I have come to the point of action, I ask you to recall what we said earlier, that you, son of Halfdane, and gold friend to retainers, that you, if I should fall and suffer death while serving your cause, would act like a father to me afterwards. If this combat kills me, take care of my young company, my comrades in arms. And be sure also, my beloved Hrothgar, to send Hujalak the treasures I received. Let the lord of the Geats gaze on that gold. Let Hrethel's son take note of it and see that I found a ring-giver of rare magnificence, and enjoyed the good of his generosity. And Unverth is to have what I inherited. To that far-famed man I bequeath my own sharp-honed, wave-sheened wonder-blade. With Hrunting I shall gain glory or die." After these words, the prince of the Weather Geats was impatient to be away, and plunged suddenly. Without more ado, he dived into the heaving depths of the lake. It was the best part of a day before he could see the solid bottom. Quickly, the one who haunted those waters, who had scavenged and gone her gluttonous rounds for 100 seasons, sensed a human observing her outlandish lair from above. So she lunged and clutched and managed to catch him in her brutal grip. But his body, for all that, remained unscathed. The mesh of the chainmail saved him on the outside. Her savage talons failed to rip the web of his war shirt. Then, once she'd touched bottom, that wolfish swimmer carried the ring-mailed prince to her court so that for all his courage, he could never use the weapons he carried. And a bewildering horde came at him from the depths, droves of sea beasts who attacked with tusks and tore at his chainmail in a ghastly onslaught. The gallant man could see he had entered some hellish turnhole, and yet the water did not work against him, because the hall roofing held off the force of the current. Then he saw firelight, a gleam and flare-up, a glimmer of brightness. The hero observed that swamp thing from hell, the tarn hag in all her terrible strength, then heaved his war sword and swung his arm. The decorated blade came down ringing and singing on her head, but he soon found his battle torch extinguished. The shining blade refused to bite. It spared her and failed the man in his need. It had gone through many hand-to-hand fights, had hewed the armor and helmets of the doomed, but here at last the fabulous powers of that heirloom failed. Huyalak's kinsman kept thinking about his name and fame. He never lost heart. Then, in a fury, he flung his sword away. The keen, inlaid, worm-loop-patterned steel was hurled to the ground. He would have to rely on the might of his arm. So must a man do who intends to gain enduring glory in a combat. Life doesn't cost him a thought. Then the Prince of Wargaetz, warming to this fight with Grendel's mother, gripped her shoulder and laid about him in a battle frenzy. He pitched his killer opponent to the floor, but she rose quickly and retaliated, grappled him tightly in her grim embrace. The sure-footed fighter felt daunted. The strongest of warriors stumbled and fell. So she pounced upon him and pulled out a broad, whetted knife. Now she would avenge her only child. But the mesh of chainmail on Beowulf's shoulder shielded his life, turned the edge and tip of the blade. The son of Edgetheow would have surely perished, and the Geats lost their warrior under the wide earth, had the strong links and locks of his war gear not helped to save him. Holy God decided the victory. It was easy for the Lord, the ruler of heaven, to redress the balance once Beowulf got back up on his feet. Then he saw a blade that boded well, a sword in her armory, an ancient heirloom from the days of the giants, an ideal weapon, one that any warrior would envy, but so huge and heavy of itself, only Beowulf could wield it in a battle. So the Scylding's hero, hard-pressed and enraged, took a firm hold of the hilt and swung the blade in an arc, a resolute blow that bit deep into her neck-bone and severed it entirely, toppling the doomed house of her flesh. She fell to the floor. The sword dripped blood. The swordsman was elated. A light appeared, and the place brightened the way the sky does when heaven's candle is shining clearly. He inspected the vault, with sword held high, its hilt raised to guard and threaten, Huyalak's thane scouted by the wall in Grendel's wake. Now the weapon was to prove its worth. The warrior determined to take revenge for every gross act Grendel had committed. And not only for that one occasion when he'd come to slaughter the sleeping troops, 15 of Hrothgar's house guards surprised on their benches and ruthlessly devoured, and as many again carried away a brutal plunder. Beowulf, in his fury, now settled that score. He saw the monster in his resting place, war-weary and wrecked, a lifeless corpse, a casualty of the battle in Heorot. The body gaped at the stroke dealt to it after death. Beowulf cut the corpse's head off. Immediately the councillors keeping a lookout with Hrothgar, watching the lake water, saw a heave-up and surge of waves and blood in the backwash. They bowed grey heads, spoke in their sage, experienced way about the good warrior, how they never again expected to see that prince returning in triumph to their king. It was clear to many that the wolf of the deep had destroyed him forever. The ninth hour of the day arrived. The brave shieldings abandoned the cliff-top, and the king went home. But sick at heart, staring at the mere, the strangers held on. They wished, without hope, to behold their lord Beowulf himself. Meanwhile, the sword began to wilt into gory icicles, to slather and thaw. It was a wonderful thing, the way it all melted as ice melts when the father eases the fetters off the frost and unravels the water ropes. He who wields power over time and tide, he is the true lord. The Geat captain saw treasure in abundance, but carried no spoils from those quarters, except for the head and the inlaid hilt embossed with jewels. Its blade had melted, and the scrollwork on it burnt, so scalding was the blood of the poisonous fiend who had perished there. Then away he swam, the one who had survived the fall of his enemies, flailing to the surface. The wide water, the waves and pools were no longer infested once the wandering fiend let go of her life and this unreliable world. The seafarer's leader made for land, resolutely swimming, delighted with his prize, the mighty load he was lugging to the surface. His thanes advanced in a troop to meet him, thanking God and taking great delight in seeing their prince back, safe and sound. Quickly the hero's helmet and mail shirt were loosed and unlaced. The lake settled, clouds darkened above the bloodshot depths. With high hearts they headed away, along footpaths and trails through the fields, roads that they knew, each of them wrestling with the head they were carrying from the lakeside cliff. Men kingly in their courage and capable of difficult work. It was a task for four to hoist Grendel's head on a spear and bear it under strain to the bright hall. But soon enough they neared the place, 14 Geats in fine fettle, striding across the outlying ground in a delighted throng around their leader. In he came, then, the Thane's commander, the arch-warrior, to address Hrothgar. His courage was proven, his glory was secure. Grendel's head was hauled by the hair, dragged across the floor where the people were drinking, a horror for both queen and company to behold. They stared in awe. It was an astonishing sight. Beowulf, son of Edgetheow, spoke. "So, son of Halfdane, prince of the Shieldings, we are glad to bring this booty from the lake. It is a token of triumph, and we tender it to you. I barely survived the battle underwater. It was hard-fought, a desperate affair that could have gone badly. If God had not helped me, the outcome would have been quick and fatal. Although Hrunting is hard-edged, I could never bring it to bear in battle. But the Lord of Men allowed me to behold, for he often helps the unbefriended, an ancient sword shining on the wall, a weapon made for giants, there for the wielding. Then my moment came in the combat, and I struck the dwellers in that den. Next thing, the damascened sword blade melted. It bloated, and it burned in their rushing blood. I have wrested the hilt from the enemy's hand, avenged the evil done to the Danes. It is what was due. And this I pledge, O Prince of the Shieldings. You can sleep secure with your company of troops in Heriot Hall. Never need you fear for a single thane of your sept or nation, young warriors or old, that laying waste of life that you and your people endured of yore." Then the gold hilt was handed over to the old lord, a relic from long ago for the venerable ruler. That rare smithwork was passed